Hi there, listener. Welcome to episode 247 of the Ski Podcast, and thanks for joining us today. This episode is an equipment special, but rather than focusing specifically on skis, boots, jackets, etc., as we do in our autumn episodes, today we're going to be tackling some of those essential questions about kit that so often get asked but rarely get addressed. What's the best way to carry skis? What's the right way to do up your boots? And how should you store your kit through the summer? We're also going to touch on the effect of tariffs on the US industry and discuss the latest developments in BOA ski boot technology. Now, my name is Ian Martin. It is a real pleasure to welcome back my regular guest today. Listeners will recognise his voice immediately, back for his first appearance on the show since episode 235, when he was reporting from the SIGB ski test in La Clusa. It's a man who knows everything it's possible to know about ski gear, our equipment expert, Al Morgan. Hi, Al. How are you?
Morning, Ian. I am good, thank you. And I am really pleased and excited because I went skiing a couple of weeks ago and skiing is always fun.
Well, okay, go on then. I normally ask that question a little bit later on, but, you know, listeners know, I always like to ask my guests, when did you ski or snowboard last? A couple of weeks ago. It's mid-May now, so that was late April, was it?
Yeah, so basically, the Espace Killy, so teen, I was in ski teen Val d'Isère, did a bit of touring up by the glacier in Val d'Isère, and it was just sublime spring skiing conditions. It was just before they close it, depending on the majority of the resort closed around about the 4th of May, something like that. So, and I was out for about 4 days, and it was a beautiful way to end the season.
Cool. And you came in after they had a massive storm, I'm going to say in like mid-April. So you came in after that. You didn't have to deal with, because the resort was cut off and they had no electricity at times, things like that. That wasn't while you were there.
No, we got the best of both worlds in that we had sunshine and easy access and a fabulous drive from Geneva. And then the resort was just covered in snow, so it had a week or so to settle down, so it was really safe. It was I mean I'm not overselling anything. It was just a lovely way to end the season. Sunshine, skiing, what more do you want, eh?
Oh well, the last time we saw each other face to face was in teen back in home, so you've been out there a few times. That was a family holiday. Was this a holiday? Were you out there specifically testing kit? Was that what you were there for?
Yeah testing kit and doing some kind of just training with so Ellis Brigham, that obviously the ski podcast does bits with anyway, they took at least one member from all of their stores out to teen for the end of season, where they get on the product for next year. So the 25-26 ranges from loads of different brands, from Nordica, Technica, Blizzard, Vulcal, Head, Armada, Atomic, Salomon, lots of them. So that it can try the skis out, try the boots. And I mean, that's amazing, because then they really know the product, and then they go through another round of training in the indoor snow dome at Tamworth in the summer. I know that happens because I sometimes go to that as well. So, yeah. And it was great to ski with them. Some of the guys that have been on the podcast as well.
Well, you mentioned Ellis Brigham, and I am going to do a shout out for Ellis Brigham. Listen, if you don't know them, this episode of the Ski Podcast is sponsored by them. They are the winter sports specialists. They have 16 shops around the UK, and you can buy all the kit that you need for next winter. Or you can go to their website, ellis-brigham.com, and buy online. And listener, just to let you know that if you might be listening to this now, but we're releasing this on YouTube as well. So if you'd like to see what Al and I look like, and it could be useful for some of the things we're going to be discussing, because we're planning to do some examples that probably won't work as audio. We'll try and explain them as best as we can. But the video will make it a little clearer. And if you're watching the video now, you'll see that behind Al, he's already pre-prepped lots of stuff. He's got at least four sets of skis behind him and different backpacks. So we're going to be finding out all about those things. We're going to come on to our kit questions a little bit later on. Firstly, I just wanted to remind listeners about this special challenge I'm taking on later this month to raise funds for Snow Camp. I think Al knows about this. I mentioned it to him when I was still coming up with the idea, but it's the 25 in 25 Snow Camp Challenge. My goal is to ski a minimum of 10 runs in each of the five indoor snow slopes around the UK. And in order that I will be skiing them will be Tamworth Snow Dome, Chill Factory in Manchester, Snow Zone Yorkshire and Castleford, Snow Zone Milton Keynes, and then finishing off at Hemel Hempstead, all on the same day. It's going to be quite an interesting challenge. We'll see how it goes. I'm driving an electric vehicle, so possibly getting it charged and getting it between the places might be a challenge as well as the physical burden. But it's called 25 and 25 because I'm aiming to raise £2,500 is the target, to give 25 inner-city young people the chance to experience snow sports in 2025. Al, have you had any contact with Snow Camp? I'm guessing you're familiar with the charity.
Yeah, in various roles throughout the centuries of working in snow sports that it sometimes feels like. Yeah, I love what they do. And actually, I've been fortunate enough to do other bits of work with some of the young people that have been through their programmes. And watching them grow, watching them get into this industry and their passion for it is so enthusing. It's brilliant.
Oh, well, that's really good to hear. And, that's the whole point of doing this. I mean, listeners, if you listened to the previous episode, you will have heard Dan Keeley from Snow Camp explaining a little bit more about what they do. But I'm going to put a link into the show notes so you can find out more about them. It's a great project. I would really love it if you could support me and sponsor me. I'm going to put a link into the Just Giving page in the show notes and on the skipodcaster.com. Just take a minute of your time. Any donation, any size would be appreciated. I'd just like to thank a few listeners who've already contributed. Sasha, Johnny Goldfell, Mike Greenland and Paul Bond. I appreciate that from all of you. Right. Let's talk equipment. Now, before we go into some of our demonstrations and tackle some of the things that I specifically wanted to look at, I don't normally kind of get into politics so much on the show, but I don't think you can be anywhere in the world and not be mindful of the fact that tariffs in and out of the USA are a big deal. And I actually blogged about this for Skipedia recently. The Snow Sports Industries of America have been briefing their members, and it's very complicated. If you're in the States and you, for example, have your gloves made in China or something like that, and people importing in the States, European made skis. Now, I know you're very linked in the industry. I just wondered, from a European point of view, perhaps how people within the industry are perceiving that, how it's going to affect things from your point of view.
Yeah, I mean, you're right in saying it's complicated if you're in America. If you're K2, if you're an American company, you get your skis manufactured in China. I mean, how complicated is that? If you're, parts are made in different bits of the world and shipped all over, it's just how it works. But I would argue it's equally as complicated in Europe. And nobody knows for certain. I've spoken with retailers and with brands, and there's a lot of just nervousness is probably the right word. A little bit anxious about what's going to happen because we don't know. We just don't know. It's such a state of flux at the minute. People are at the minute holding their nerve. Prices are already set for next season. Will things change down the line? I mean, what's going to happen next week? We just don't know. What's going to happen 2 weeks, 4 weeks, never mind 4 months. So if you're looking at kit, get it sooner rather than later, maybe. That's one way to look at it. I am no economics expert. This is going to have an impact on skiing one way or the other. That's all we can say, I think.
Yeah, for sure. We're not going to be able to answer it here, but you're right. It's that uncertainty of not knowing how things are going to change. But I have blogged about it, and I'm going to put a link to that in there. But one thing I found interesting is it's not just about the tariffs on the different countries as far as the States is concerned. There's a tariff on aluminium or aluminum content, if you want to put it like that as well. And, evidently lots of ski boots have that as part of their production.
Yeah, absolutely right. And even things like titanium, however you want to say it, the layer of metal in skis, which is in a lot of skis. It impacts all of these things. So, yeah, it's complicated, isn't it?
Let's move on to something more simple, but is possibly getting more complicated. I think at the SIGB ski test, we've talked quite a lot about the BOA fixings on ski boots. And it's been revolutionary. And I think, that's been incorporated by so many different brands now. And, my wife has a pair of BOA ski boots. Lots of people say to me the way you can cinch them up is so much easier than using, previous regular buckles. However, one of the developments we've seen is that for next season, there's not just going to be a single boa which goes over, let's say, the body of your foot, but the yeah. top buckle could be replaced by a boa as well. So yeah. I guess this is a two-part question. Have you tested a couple of these boots and what did you think? And secondly, how many boas can you get on a ski boot?
Yeah, I've got some friends that made an absolutely brilliant video mocking the boa thing where they had literally hundreds of boa on boots. It was very funny. You'll find it on you. It was quite popular. It got circulated quite a lot. But at the minute you get it on the, I'm going to grab a boot. So at the minute this was kind of the original style where you get it on the shell. So that's boa. But now you can also get it on shell and cuff, called dual boa. And I actually interviewed K2, who were one of the original companies in with boa for development boots. They were actually the original company for snowboard boots with boa. And they'd said how boa said you couldn't have it just on the cuff. But Nordica, an Italian company, and when I talked to them, I go, yeah, it's Italian style. They've gone with they actually have it a model with boa just on the cuff and clips on the clog on the shell here, the lower bit. So there's various different configurations you can have. It'll either be one or two boa, basically. But when it's on the cuff, on this part of the boot, what's really interesting, and I've been playing with that style of boot for quite a while, and some of the designers are saying, oh, some people like two clip on the cuff because you can get different tension on the bottom part of the cuff to the top part, and you can't do that with boa. But I've spoken to so many people in testing this boot and getting various leg shapes, profiles in it, either really tapered or really straightened. And it seemed to have worked for everybody. And nobody, and I asked them specifically this question, are you missing that you can do different tension top and bottom? They go, I didn't even notice. So you get this fantastic wrap around your leg. One thing that is really, really evident, though, if you are used to a four-clip boot and how that flexes, you can get exactly the same flexing boot in dual boa, and it will likely feel different in its flex pattern because the boot, the way that the boot is wrapping around you, the way that the buckles aren't. So when a, can I get a regular four-clip boot? There's going to be a lot of grabbing things. I'm very sorry. When you get a regular four-clip boot, like, where's the camera, like this, and it flex forwards, essentially these can, that can block. It can flex forward and block depending on the boot. And you don't get that with boa. So actually, the way that the boot flexes can feel different. Some people go, no, the boot feels much softer. It's not. It's exactly the same stiffness of plastic. It feels different.
Okay. So, you know, previously in our ski boot episodes, and I'll put a link in the show notes, where we talked about what that 100, 110, 120, 130 means in terms of the flexibility of the boot. Would two boas work on a more flexible boot?
Good question. Now, boa is more expensive. Every time you put a boa dial on a boot, you're adding, let's say, £60. It varies, but let's say £60 per buckle, per boa system to the boot. So you're going to put two of those on. So it generally is only on the higher price point boots, and higher price point boots are generally stiffer. So it's really only on 100 flex and upwards that we're going to see dual boa.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it'll be really interesting. You know, we'll cover this when we get to our ski boot episode in the autumn. But I just wanted to flag it and, you know, do a little shout out for the two people, Noddy Gowans and Tord Nielsen, who produced that amazing video, which I'm going to put a link to the show.
And there's loads. They did it at the end of the SIGB ski test, and quite a few of the people that were at the test were involved in that. I'd gone. I knew it was coming. Because I took some of the stuff out for Tord, but yeah, it's brilliant, that video. It's so funny.
It's very funny. So if you like that boa technology, then this will amuse you for sure. Okay, let's stick in the ski boot area then and tackle some of our questions, because a sort of question that has been asked to me before. Let's go back to that four buckle boots that you had a second ago. Is there a right way or a wrong way of doing up your buckles? You know, what would you recommend? Because, you know, definitely get that question. And I have my own way of doing it, but you tell me what you think.
Yeah, okay. Yes and no. So my boots fit me really well. So I know exactly what you're thinking me different size on different days and at different times of the day. So that's a caveat to put in here. But I generally run my boot. I'm fortunate that I have a few different boots depending on what I'm doing, and I know where each of those boots clips up. Sometimes I actually put a mark on the shelf or where it goes on the ladder, just so I know. I'm just go bang bang and off I go. And my boots fit so well that the order doesn't seem to matter so much for me. However, I'm about to contradict that slightly. If you talk to industry experts, so people in retail, whatever, you will generally get advised to do, I'm going to call the very top buckle one, the second one down the cuff two, the one over the top of the instep three, and the one over the toe four, just for ease of remembering. So you'll generally get advised to do the cuff buckles, one and two, but ideally two is what you do. And if we look, I'm going to hold the boot towards the camera, but at the bottom of the cuff of the boot, we have this arch shape in the cuff, and that's in all ski boots. So when we fasten that part of the cuff up, it wraps around, but it also helps to close the bit around your foot, which we call the shell. So if you're doing the shell first and then you wrap this up, you're gonna have to redo the shell anyway. But also what you're doing is clamping the foot down, and what you want to be doing is pulling the leg back into the boot, because what's really critical in skiing is that your heel is held really positively, securely in the heel pocket of the boot. And by doing the cuff, and especially this number two buckle up, that helps do it. Now, there are different kinds of boots. So as we showed that boa boot before, that's got two clips on the cuff. So we do the same process, and then we do the boa up afterwards. So Armada have a new boot coming out. So this is the AR1 130MV. And we can see that the buckle for this is actually completely over what we call the throat of the boot, that kink, that right angle. So if we do that, that actually helps pull our heel back in the boot. And there's only one buckle on the cuff. So play around with your boots. Find what helps pull you into the heel pocket best, and use that. If you're using the regular where you've got two clips on the cuff, definitely focus on the cuff first. And it's that bottom one of those two buckles that's going to help.
Cool. That's really useful. Now, notice that you're wearing a hat. Phenom, which is a new ski boot brand. I think it's a ski boots by the company that produce Faction skis. Is that right?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Phenom. And you know, we discussed it. I'm pretty sure we discussed it in our ski boot episode, because there is a really high level of sustainability with these boots. I've got a feeling it's to do with the recyclability of the materials, but that's not what I want to ask you about. I happened to see a video the other day with their boots where they were suggesting the way to put them on was to put the liners on first around your foot outside the boot and then slip your liner into the boot. Now, that seems quite unusual to me. Would you ever kind of think about
it? I've got a little test for you on this. Yeah, okay. What was special about that liner, apart from the fact it's got a grippy sole so you can walk around on it and it's got loads of recycled content in it, what did they do to that liner before they stepped into the boot? Can you remember? That's like being at school.
No, I don't know about that.
They laced the liner up. So if you're in a race boots have laces around your leg, because when you put a race liner is really thin and a race boot is really stiff. So with a race boot, you put the liner on and then you slide in the boot and you get aftermarket liners, zip fit, brilliant aftermarket liners. You lace that boot up. And then you ideally then slide it into the shell. In a regular boot where you don't have laces, it's much harder to do. So you would generally step in with the liner in the shell. So
and just to clarify there, long time listeners will know that I've been using a Carve over the last few years, and I had a Carve One, which has a footbed that sits inside your ski boot. And it was replaced with the Carve 2. And because it had these cables coming up and they were in the way, I had to get that Carve footbed and take it out of my ski boot and take the inner out and the liner out. And, oh, my God, it was quite difficult, like, getting it back fixed. Again. I was really nervous about it. I got it out fine. And then it took me ages to jam it back in again. So I'm not in favor of taking the liners out.
Okay, there are tricks to doing it. So I don't know if you want to go down this rabbit hole. It's not going to be a very big rabbit hole. every time you ski, especially if it's like every day that I ski, I take my liners out like at night and let them air dry. Yeah, I don't put them on a radiator. I don't heat up. They've generally been heat molded of some sort. I've actually seen somebody melt their snowboard boot on a radiator. So I'm always very, I don't want to put my boots on it. But there are some tricks. So hopefully we can make this work for radio, if you know what I mean. So most liners will have a loop on the back. If they don't, you can still just grab the back. So on the camera, I'm just showing I've got the heel of my hand against the back of the liner, my fingers inside, and I'm just holding the top of the back of the liner. Now, most people, I'll try and stop that buckle rattling. Most people try and pull the liner towards them. That is really, really difficult. So if you get, if you're doing it on a lap, I've just got the boot on my lap at the minute. I've got my left hand, because I'm right-handed, in the back of the top of the shell, in the back of the cuff, and I've got my thumb in that pull loop on the back of the line. And all I'm going to do, all of the buckles are undone, the bow is undone. When you undo the buckles, put at least a half turn in them so they don't catch again. Yeah, a little trick. But put your thumb in the loop and just push it away from you. And it is so easy. And this is a 130 yeah. flex boot. And it's yeah. the same in my race boots. It's really easy to do if you push it away. So that's getting it out.
And my question is, so you said that you take out your liners every night after skiing yeah. to dry yeah. them without putting them on a heater, yeah?
Without on a heater, yeah, absolutely. Now, if you leave it, so I've just got the shell in my hand with no liner in it, and the cuff, especially if it's near a heat source and it's not done up, we'll try and relax and it'll straighten out a bit. That's generally what happens. So ideally what you want to do is just fasten the buckles up just to keep the shape of the plastic a bit better. Yeah, that, and it's the same in storage, but we might talk about storage later on. This is a lace-up liner, so you can lace this up and step in, but it's a free ride boot with a walk mode. I just tend to step in like a normal liner on this. Now, you can just put your hand inside the boot shirt, inside the boot liner, but you curve it around by the ankle. So the back of your wrist is essentially around by the ankle, or at least your knuckles. And you're going to curve the boot that way. So I'm just pointing the toes towards the floor and curving them around under my elbow. And that's how we get it inside the shell. So, but especially with a free ride boot where it's got all that walk mechanism in the back, that can get caught and make it a little bit more difficult. So there's a couple of tricks. So I'll make that shape round and squeeze the heel and push down. And you do both of those things at the same time and it goes in. It can be a bit of a struggle, but you can do it. There is a product called Boot Bib. There's been various versions around, but Boot Bib's about a tenner, I think. And you put that in the shell before you slide the liner in, and that makes it so much easier. But the other beauty with this, because some people struggle getting into their ski boots, is you put the Boot Bib inside the liner once it's in the shell and step in, and then you just pull the Boot Bib out, and that makes it much easier. Just chuck it in your ski bag when you're traveling. You don't need to take it around with it during the day. But the thing that I like about that, often the back of a liner, where like this one, I've actually had to re-glue because in and out of the shell, you end up pulling this sole off a little bit. And I've seen a few people damage their boots doing that, and the Boot Bib can just help prevent that happening.
That is super interesting, all of that, how to do it, and also the Boot Bib, which I'd never heard of. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Hey, look, let's stay on boots, because you said we'd refer to it later. We're kind of moving around a little bit, but okay, boots. More people have boots than skis. What about storing them over the summer then? What's your recommendations for that? How do you do it, and how should they be left?
Right. Shout out to Colin Martin, Solutions for the episode, episode 161, I think. He talks about this. Good. Sheds and lofts get really hot in the summer. Plastic and heat, interesting mix, isn't it? So try and keep them where the temperature variation throughout the summer, throughout the year, is pretty constant. So a wardrobe in a bedroom is a really nice place. It's not in direct sunlight. It's not next to a direct heat source, I hope. And it doesn't get as hot as a loft or a shed, something like that. So that's a really good place to store. I know a few people that will just store it at the back of the bottom of their wardrobe. That works fantastically well. But as I mentioned, the key is, like I would on a normal day skiing, make sure the boot is dry before you put it. Don't come back from your last ski trip and just chuck it in storage where it's going to get moldy and a bit stanky, as my kids would call it. So take the liner out, let it air dry at home. Brilliant. Let the footbed air dry. Often you've got moisture inside the shell, so you want that to dry as well. Then when everything is, after a couple of days of just drying, pop the liner back in, dead easy now we know how, obviously. Do the boot up as though you were going to ski in it, because it'll just keep the shape of the boot better, and then store it out of direct sunlight, out of variations in heat, especially when it's getting really, really hot.
Cool. Okay. And anything you need to do? Do you need to oil the buckles or anything like that?
No. Yeah. Just do it up as though you're going to ski in it. Try not to leave even the things like the power strap, whether it's Velcro, whether it's a claw strap like this on this Armada boot, just have those done up so things are in the shape that you want them to be when you go skiing. It's also a great time to check for wear and tear, especially soles of boots where you walk around and maybe you need to replace it. The summer's a great time to do that. You know, there's shops will, if they don't carry the spare part, can order it for you. Don't wait until 2 days before your first ski trip to realize your boots needs a new sole. Do it in the summer.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, cool. Well, I think that's really interesting. We covered lots of things about boots there. And as we're talking about storing stuff for the summer, then let's move on to skis. So skis, you know, very specialized piece of equipment like boots. Yeah. There must be a specific way of preparing those and how you store them for that long period of non-use over the summer months.
Yeah, the basic bits are pretty similar to a ski boot. When you get back from your ski trip, make sure it's dry. Make sure it's, you know, keep the moisture off the edges. So before you pack the car to come home, or before you pack your ski bag, before it goes in the airline, just give it a dry down with a towel so the edges don't oxidize or get rusty. You know, when people look at that tarnish, it's not just about the brown rust, they can go black as well. You can actually come home and get storage wax put on them. So it's just a base of wax on the, a layer of wax on the base, and it can go over the edges just to stop moisture damaging the edges and also to stop the base drying out. That's a good way to do it. It's also a brilliant time to take them to a local retailer so they can check the bases, fill any gouges that need doing, tune the edges before they put the storage wax. So next season, all they need is a scrape off of wax and a brush down. The thing that I would encourage people to do, again, like boots, keep them away from massive variations in temperature, keep them away from moisture, keep them away from direct sunlight. But bindings. So I'm holding a toe piece of a, it says head, obviously it's a Tyrolia binding, it's the same company. These have springs in them to hold you in securely and allow you to come out when you want to. Now, if we keep a spring compressed, then it's not going to have the same elasticity that it may have had. So on this one, for example, it goes 3 to 11. I've just wound it down to 3, the lowest setting. Try not to wind.
Just to clarify there, you know, for people who might not be aware, this is your kind of din setting, isn't it?
When you go into a ski hire shop,
for example, if you don't own your own skis and you go into a ski hire shop and they ask you about your height and your weight and your experience of skiing, and then they'll consult a chart and decide what din setting they're going to give you. On your own skis, you can choose that. But you're saying it's very important to release that through the summer.
Yeah, I just let the springs relax. So the din is that number that's going to dictate what force your boot needs to release from the binding. So when a tumble, you can come out. Yeah, when you're skiing, you're held in. So that's the din number. So the reason why I'm saying just wind it down to the lowest number and try not to go past that, because this, for example, if you wind it down too low, you can take the whole assembly apart and the heel piece, the spring comes out, everything comes out. Then you go, oh, I've done something a bit wrong. So only go as low as the lowest number. Now, how are you going to remember what din you're on? So I write it on my skis between the toe and the heel piece of the binding on the ski. I write down the din number. So I know next year when I come back, I can just set it exactly where it is, wind it back. If you're unsure, just talk to your ski shop about it. Yeah. Can they wind the din that's down for you? And then next year, can they set them? And the other thing that's worth noting is my weight changes quite a lot winter to summer. So when I go into a season and when I finish a season, if I consult the din chart, I might have swapped thresholds on what that din number needs to be. So then that'll just need setting appropriately. And if you change boots, it's not about din. There's another spring in the binding. If you change boots, go to your ski shop, get them to check something called the forward pressure. And that's how much pressure is exerted along the sole of the boot in the binding.
That, lots of things that are interesting there. Firstly, I find it very hard to believe that Al, who is definitely, if you're not watching on a video, he's a very talented athlete. You can run very fast. I can't believe you put on large amounts of weight over the summer. However, my question is, do you have, you're writing it down, your din setting, do you have different dins on different skis? I know you have a quiver of skis.
I do have a quiver of skis. I'm very lucky. That's what you get when you work for centuries in skiing, as I mentioned earlier. And you spend a lot of money on kit. The din doesn't matter for the ski. So if you consult the chart, it is just about your height, weight, age, ski ability, boot sole length. Yeah, they're generally the criteria that you're looking at. And it doesn't matter for the ski. Now, if I'm going to be skiing a race ski really fast and I'm going to be skiing, just skiing around with my kids, not doing very much, I might have a different din because the speeds at which I might take a tumble are different and hitting compressions, etc. But that's getting pretty technical. Really, I ski on the same din on all of my skis, whether I'm on pins, which aren't strictly a din, it's a release value, whether I'm on a race binding, etc. It is the same din that I have, and it's okay. The same written on all my skis.
Okay, that's interesting.
Toe and heel. You don't have a different one for your toe, you don't have a different one for your heel or different feet. It's the same number on all bits.
Okay. And next question then. When you talk about storing boots, about doing it up so that the boot keeps its shape. Now, evidently, skis, we've discussed this in our ski equipment episodes, but they are shaped. They all have different shapes. They operate, most modern skis have a specific camber or rocker built in. Yes. So do you need to protect that shape when you're storing them as well? Or what I mean is, potentially you could store them in a way where you put them out of shape perhaps.
Absolutely correct. So don't do what I have behind me where all the skis are leaning against the wall at varying angles, because one ski is gonna bend one way and the other ski is going to be bending the opposite direction. You know what I mean? You and don't have ski ties binding them really, in between the bindings you generally have a gap called camber. And if you put a ski tie there and flattened that ski and held it, and it got really warm in a loft or shed, I know we said don't do that, but people do, all the resin that's holding it in that might relax a bit if it gets really hot. And then, you're going to be compressing that wood and trying to change its shape. So lying the skis down on a flat surface, they can be tied together just to hold them loosely. You're not going to do it mega tight. And whenever you put a ski tie on a ski, put it where the skis naturally touch. That's what I always do. If we look at there's a red ski behind me with a ski tie across the Black Crow's name, because that's where the skis touch each other, yeah? So I'm not losing the camber on that ski.
I can tell you, Al, that when you pointed behind you just then, your finger was exactly pointing at those red skis.
Oh, nice.
Okay. I don't know how you managed to do that, but very impressive. Okay, let's stay with skis then. Now I can see, you've got four sets of skis behind you there. We're going to move on to, how you might attach them to backpacks, and I can see a few of them are like that. What about a question that always, not necessarily a question, it might be aesthetics. In my mind, there's a right way and a wrong way to carry your skis. There's many wrong ways to carry your skis, but there's only one right way to carry your skis, and to my mind that's to have them over your shoulder with the tips facing forward. Now I wondered if you had a view on that and if you would care to demonstrate on video if you do have
people make this so complicated carrying skis. So that is a great way to carry them. I bet you don't carry them like that in a lift line. So there are various ways to carry them. If you're walking through a busy crowd of people swinging around with skis on your shoulder, hitting everybody in the head, you're not going to be that popular. So you have to be aware of where you are and who and what are around you. There's a trick to that. First of all, the bindings go behind your shoulder. So the tips of the skis are in front of you and the bindings sit. So the toe piece sits behind your shoulder. And the reason for this is it's counterweight. Your arm rests on the front of the ski. Shall I try it? It's going to go all wrong on a chair.
No, it'll be perfect.
Okay, so the binding.
Oh, you've got a fifth pair of skis there.
Ah, there's more on the floor. So on the camera, I'm pointing at the brakes where the brakes interlock on the side of the ski. And you'll see that one brake sits in front of the other brake. So the furthest most brake goes on the top when you carry them, and that's to stop that top ski sliding forward. If you do it like the wrong way, so the brake on the front, that ski can just slide out the way. So the furthest most brake of the pair, the one that's interlocked, goes on the top, skis over your shoulder, so the toe piece is by your shoulder, and your arm just rests on the front of the ski. So you can hold your poles there, or you have your poles in the other hand and use them for balance, etc.
Now, to my mind, that is the perfect demonstration there. And to those of you who aren't watching on YouTube, how managed to do all that without even standing up? He just leaned over backwards.
Yeah, I don't have anybody stood behind me, thankfully.
And put them over his shoulder. But, you know, to me, you know, I think I'm a bit of a snob about this, but carrying your skis in any other way just looks so amateurish. It's what, back in the day when I was doing ski seasons, we'd call kind of, I'd never like to use this word, and I ban my staff from using it, but it makes you look like a punter. You know, yeah, if you carry your ski.
Yeah, but now, so I have an instructor friend, a British champ, everything, which is amazing. And Lynn once told me that one of the first things she does with her groups is teaches them how to carry the skis over the shoulder, because she doesn't want her group looking like, as you say. And actually, it's really comfortable and really balanced. Now, just a little bit, obviously, we spoke about the little tip with the brakes. With your poles, often poles have a little notch in the basket, so the poles can, where's the other one gone, clip together like that, so that when you're carrying them or when you're walking with your poles in one hand, they are still fastened together. So that makes it easier. Get rid of that prop. But my wife cannot carry skis over her shoulder. She finds it really uncomfortable, painful, and she doesn't like it. So the other way that you can carry them. So again, we're going to talk about a trick with the brakes. When we do it this way, you carry it so your arm just goes out and you just put your fingers under the toe piece. Now, purposely holding the wrong ski, because if you watch what happens, yeah. Ideally, again, the brake that's at the bottom, your hand goes on that ski to stop the other ski falling. Because if you hold it the other way and you do a bump, the skis come apart. Yeah?
Yeah.
And that's...
I mean,
yeah?
It's kind of just obvious, think about you'd think.
Yeah, but people don't think about it. But the other beauty that I have to move a lot of skis about in testing. Tens, maybe hundreds of pairs. So I can put one finger under one binding and I can carry another ski beside it. Wow. So if you've got to carry this kid's skis around, this is a great way to carry them.
Okay. Okay, cool. Well, that is a really good tip. Okay, so that I think everybody who goes skiing, you know, they need to know how to carry their skis, and hopefully we've clarified that. Not everybody owns their own skis, but you might rent them at times, and you could be doing some backcountry. Now, behind you there, you've got a lot of sets of skis and backpacks. And ski touring, pretty straightforward, but you don't always necessarily ski tour from a point. Sometimes you have to do a bit of bootpacking, walking with your skis to be able to get to that point. And all modern backpacks, I would say all modern backpacks, a certain number of backpacks, have different ways of attaching the skis to them. And you've got a few examples there. And I wondered if it would be possible just to show us a few of those, because I'm pretty sure there'll be some listeners who have decent backpacks, but just have no idea of how to attach the skis to them. Obviously, you could put them over your shoulder and you could climb holding your...
Yeah, and sometimes that's the quickest, because it's a two-minute...
Sometimes if it's really steep as well, it's almost easier to do that, because if you have your skis on your backpack, they can dig into the snow behind you. But go on, let's have a look at the setups that you've got.
So there. If you're going to do a very... If you're going to get somewhere and you're going to do a two-minute... It will take you 5 minutes to put your skis, get your bag off, put skis. So just put them over your shoulder, dead quick. You don't have to use any straps. You just put them over your shoulder, off you go. You got your poles for balance. Some people use it on really steep stuff and some big stuff in the backcountry. Some people will just bootpack. And it depends on the terrain. Before we get in the bags, the other way, when you're hiking up bootpacking, I'm going to grab a ski, sorry, again. You might actually be using the skis to pull yourself up the snow as balance. So if you're on pin bindings...
Yeah, I just want to chip in here. I did that with Warren Smith in Verbier a couple of years ago. And he said, oh, look, you know, we've come too low. Let's just go up a little bit like this and we can loop round here. And there have been some avalanches, you know, like the previous day. And I've got to say, I was a little nervous, because when you're using your skis like that, you're literally sort of pulling some snow down towards it. It was all fine. But another way of going up. Not my favourite method.
Yeah, but sometimes on steep stuff, as you say, if you've got weight on your bag, it's either going to pull you backwards, or if you're coming downhill, the skis are going to catch. Pin bindings are great, because if you don't have a ski tie on these, you can just wrap your pole straps around the ski, twist your poles a couple of times, that holds it like a ski strap.
And then your poles are just locked in the pins. I've got no straps on this. It's really secure. I can carry it and get up. So that's one way to carry them. Now, when you attach them to a bag, there will be different straps. So I'm going to point. This is just an Osprey bag. That's called A-frame. So when we look at the skis are tied together at the top. And then one ski comes down one side of the backpack, one ski comes down the other, and it makes the letter A, hence A-frame. This is brilliant when you are going uphill. It's really balanced. It's really secure. Careful when you lean forward on any of these. Always do the waist strap up on the backpack. Otherwise, the skis can be top heavy and hit you in the back of the head. I have cut my head doing that, so that's not very nice. It's not as good for coming downhill because your heels tend to catch the skis. So in that case, I'm going to swing the other way. And this ski is on a diagonal carry. And this is really quick to do because you don't have to separate the skis. You don't have to put a different ski on each side of the bag. It's very quick to do. It's not as secure, depending on how full the bag is. That can wobble a little bit. Now, this is an oldish Black Diamond Jet Force Avalanche airbag. You can only carry skis diagonally on this because the airbag deploys around the side of the bag, so you cannot carry them in A-frame. Because the skis are carried diagonally, and we'll talk about helmets in a bit, I've put the helmet on the bottom of this bag because it can't go where the skis are. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And then another one.
Specifically, just to clarify, it's an airbag.
It is an avalanche
airbag. I'm guessing most listeners will be aware of that, but essentially there's a little kind of toggle that you can pull if you end up in an avalanche where it will expand around you and float you to the top of the snow. Because that comes from the sides, you've got to have your skis in that diagonal position.
Yeah. So just that, because I like to be a bit dependent. So it increases your surface area. So there's a thing as substrates shake, the bigger particles go to the top. So you're not actually floating, although BCA call theirs the float. It just increases your surface area. So you're going to be one of the bigger lumps of snow if you want. You'll be on the top of the snowpack. This Patagonia bag, which I absolutely love, it's a really small, neat backpack. And of all the bags here, it's got the most stuff put on it today. Again, you can carry diagonally. You cannot carry A-frame on this bag. But if you'll notice, I've got the skis to one side because then my helmet can go on the back and I've got an ice axe on it. So anybody that's listening, when you're carrying skis A-frame, the helmet can often go between them. When you're carrying diagonally, often you'll put the helmet on the backpack at the top of the bottom so it's not getting squashed, or you can wrap it around. But it will depend on the design of the pack. Practice at home. Find a space where you can lay everything out on the floor, put some stuff in the bag. These have got pillows and jumpers in them just to pad them out, and practice putting stuff on. But put your avalanche safety kit in. Put all those bits on so you know where all the lumps and bumps are. Don't learn how to do it at the bottom of a boot pack when you're thinking, oh my, I've got half an hour up before I've got to ski. Sort all that at home.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's just like, everything, isn't it? Planning and preparation prevents poor performance.
Yeah.
You need to be doing these things in advance, for sure. And you talked about the other bits and pieces. So you referred with the airbag, to the helmet. You don't want to be, when you're doing the boot packing bit, when you're ski touring up, no one wants to be wearing a helmet. I know in our helmet episode, we do talk about ventilation and it is possible. But, typically when I'm ski touring up, I'm just going to wear a buff or something like that, maybe a cap, and then put the helmet on later so that you need to be able to store it either inside or more typically on the outside of your backpack. Yes. And again, that's just going to depend on the type of backpack you have.
Yeah, absolutely. So the... in the easiest form, you use the chin strap of the helmet, you put it through a loop on the bag, you clip it on. It swings around horribly. It changes the balance of the backpack. Your helmet gets banged on skis or rocks. Don't do it. Just don't do it. It's not good for you. It's not good for the helmet. So a lot of them will have a helmet net. So I'm just pointing over my shoulder at an Osprey bag with skis in A-frame. We have the helmet on the bag with a helmet net. Chin strap of that helmet is also looped through part of the bag, just done up. So I was touring in Scotland with some people who are been in ski industry for a long time, ex-Olympians, all sorts of things. And people's helmets would fall out of their nets when we're climbing or ascending. And
always make sure you clip the helmet to the bag as well as putting it in the net. And then if it does slip out, get knocked out by the skis, or when you're shimmying through a gully, whatever it may be, or you take a slip, you don't lose your helmet down the hill. And I have seen it happen more than once. So always keep it on.
Not ideal. Can I just chip in on that? So yes. I've actually got my helmet net here, which I'm going to try and, there we go, position that.
Yeah.
Now that came with the backpack. And some people might not even realize, you know, what that's for when it comes with the backpack. But it's kind of, I guess, fairly evident that it slops around the helmet, and then each of these corners attaches onto the backpack itself. And, you know, I found that that is a really good way to keep it tight and plush to the backpack. And makes it, you know, easier for carrying the weight. You know, I did have a backpack before. I tried to shove the helmet in, and it just doesn't really work very well. It's possible to do it. And as you say, just clipping it on is a disaster.
Some people lose those nets. I've lost one on a funicular before. So I was away when I was in, I mentioned I was in skiing in Teen the other week, and one of the guys that I was with, he didn't use a helmet net. He's got two carabiners on his bag. So I've got a bag here, two carabiners, and he just, it's clanging because he's got a metal buckle. He just put the chin strap through. Now, you'll note I haven't done the helmet this way because if it snows, it all fills with snow. I've done it with the back facing up to try and cover as much of the inside of the helmet as possible. But that's really secure. It doesn't swing around a little bit, but not the same as just attaching it on one point. So that's a good way to do it. There's a female freeride athlete, Fionn Townsend, that I do lots of testing with. She's amazing. Yeah, climber, all sorts. I've never seen her attach a helmet to a bag. She always puts it inside her backpack. And she's generally skiing with a bag that has a roll top closure. So that means you can make it bigger. So this is a one with a semi roll top. So there's a, like a rope strap. So there's a strap that goes over the bag to close it. But it also means you can quickly just put the helmet inside. Now, on this, I've even attached the helmet again so it can't just fall out.
Yeah.
If you've got a roll top bag, like, you know, like the top of a dry bag when you roll it down and do the clips up, that's brilliant to shove a helmet in. That is the most secure way to put a helmet on, and it protects it. You're not going to lie the bag.
Yeah, for sure. You're not going to lose that rolling down the slope. And also the way the weight is distributed on that looks quite good for climbing as well.
Yeah, yeah. And that, you know, she does a lot of mountaineering, a lot of climbing, and I don't doubt some of it is to do with that. But it's just secure, looks after the helmet. I generally carry mine on a helmet net. It's quick and easy. If you put, lots of people will attach their helmet to their bag with goggles on. So I'm pointing at a bag with a helmet attached. You see a white thing on it. So if you're going to do that, look after the lens. You're not going to put it in a goggle bag, but this goggle in my hand just has a goggle sock on it. Shove a goggle sock over the lens. Goggles, they look after your eyes. It's so important, and they can be quite expensive. £15 or something for a goggle sock. Shove it on if you're going to leave it on your helmet on a bag. It looks after it much better.
Yeah, and listener, you know, if you want one of those, I've got a bunch of them spare because I keep being given them by different resorts. So, I don't know, drop me an email to theskipodcast@gmail.com, and the first couple of people, I'll just send them out to you. Also, on the helmet, on the goggles, having them attached to your helmet, if you're doing a bit of bootpacking or ski touring or just, you know, getting in between, just make sure they are clipped on and attached properly. If you did lose a pair, you know, really expensive mistake.
Yeah,
it's so annoying. I got to the bottom, you know, having done a very, very long traverse, got to the bottom, no goggles anymore. So irritating.
It's a mistake you only make once.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. What about, this is another aesthetic thing, you know, to do with carrying skis. I don't know if you have a view on this. You know, I just think two things. Firstly, if you're wearing a helmet, I just don't think sunglasses work with a helmet. You need to be wearing goggles. I just don't like that look, but, you know, each to their own. But also something that we talk about or gets referred to is the helmet gap, you know, avoiding the helmet gap. You don't want to have your goggles, you know, to here and your helmet up to here. It just looks really bad, in my opinion. Maybe I'm being snobbish about it. What do you think?
It's a practical thing as well, because I'm grabbing a helmet. 1 second. There we go. So you don't want the gap. A, if it's really cold, you're going to get a real cold spot. You don't want to get any kind of frostbite or anything in there. You don't want to get sunburned if it's really sunny. I'm with you, aesthetic. It looks much better, but that's not how it's designed. The helmets have vents. This helmet's black. It's hard to see. They have vents just above the goggle that sit in the brim. That's designed to go on top of the goggle mesh to vent air out, keep the goggles free of fog. Now, most helmets have an adjuster. So I'm holding a helmet up and you can pull the liner forward and you can actually slide the cradle, the plastic cradle that wraps around your head. You can slide it up and down to change that gap. So if you slide the cradle down, it'll make the front of the helmet comes a bit lower on your forehead. If you push the cradle up, if I can do that, there we go. It will pull the front of the helmet a bit further up your forehead and it'll just marry with the goggles a bit better and stop the goggles squashing the top of your nose as well if they're a bit tight.
Yeah, good. What do you think about sunnies with helmets?
I don't do it very often. If I've done a quick bit of skinning and I shove a helmet on to go down a bit and then go back up, I might do it. I know loads of instructors that ski like this. I look like a complete plonker when I do this. The instructors look amazing. So I don't know whether it's just how I view these people or they have a certain skill. Some of my glasses just don't fit with helmets, but instructors do it. And it seems to work really well. Again, practice at home, so you have the look and style that you want and that everything works.
Well, you know, generally, I'm definitely a believer in, you know, whatever works for you. But there's certain things like how you carry your skis. I don't like it.
I'm with you on the skis thing. I'm with you on the skis thing.
Okay, one more question then about, let's say, keeping your kit in good shape over the summer. We've talked about, boots and skis. What about outerwear? Should you be cleaning them, reproofing them? What's the best way to do that?
Yes, absolutely. Ideally, every week that you wear your ski clothing, mid layers, base layers, often it's slightly different with the stuff that's against your skin. You might have a few pairs during the week, but you'll generally have one set of outerwear, the stuff that's protecting you from the wind, the snow, the rain. And people often don't touch it, don't do anything. They bring it back, they shove it in a cupboard, get it back on the ski next year. If you want it to last as long as possible and perform as it was designed, treat it as a technical piece of equipment. And this means don't shove it in a washing machine and wash it with your regular detergent and softener. This has teeny little pores in the membrane. You're going to clog things up. It's not going to breathe as it should. So often people go, oh, I'm getting really wet in my jacket, and it's just not breathing. So they're getting wet for their own sweat rather than rain, which is delightful when we talk about it, isn't it? So depending on the garment, I'm holding a shell jacket. So this has no insulated lining, no padding in it at all. It's very thin. If you're doing this, I've just always used Nikwax. So I'm holding up a bottle of Tech Wash in my hand. There's various brands. You go to an Arc'teryx store where they can do this for you. They have their own bottles of stuff. This is a shell piece, so I use wash-in cleaner. Yeah, this Tech Wash, and TX Direct is the wash-in reproofer. They also do a squeezy bottle. So if your garment has any kind of padding, insulation, or a separate hanging lining, so it's not just one, what feels like one layer, you will need the spray to reproof it, but you'll just use the normal Tech Wash to wash it. It's the same. Grainger's makes them. Loads of different brands make them. And then to go to a good outdoor shop, doesn't have to be a ski shop, talk to them about your garment and get the right products. But every week of use, ideally you want to certainly wash it, and ideally wash and reproof so that the water, when it does hit, it just beads it, runs off.
Okay, that's really interesting. And also you mentioned Arc'teryx there. We've covered that before. I'm pretty sure, if I recall this correctly, from the shop in Covent Garden that they have, that if you take in your garment, they'll do that reproofing for you for free, won't they?
It obviously needs to be an Arc'teryx piece. I had a zip that had worn out on Arc'teryx jacket and I took it in. They just replaced the slider for free. It was brilliant. But when I booked in to do it, they said, oh, you come to get it washed as well. I didn't need that washed at the time. I'd washed it before taking it. So, it's great. What a service.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, I'll put links to Nikwax and that Arc'teryx episode in the show notes as well. Cool. That is super interesting, Al. All of those different things that we've covered there. I really enjoy these episodes because it's just so interesting to me. I hope, I'm pretty sure it's interesting to listeners as well. Just finding out more and being able to tap into your huge knowledge is brilliant. So thank you very much for that. And listeners, we will have our regular series of episodes in the autumn where we'll have separate episodes where we'll look at skis, the best boots, jackets, helmets, goggles, gloves, socks, I think. Oh, and we'll have a ski touring episode as well. And then possibly this year, we're looking at maybe doing a specific episode about what kind of kit to get for your kids, for your children as well, because that's always a kind of big decision as to whether or not you invest in getting something when they're growing. And if you are going to do that, you know, without doing it, without breaking the bank. So I have talked to Ellis Brigham about that, but that's a plan anyway. So that's brilliant, Al. Thank you very much. We're going to move to the close now. So listeners, if you enjoyed the episode, you know, let me know. And equally with all of our other episodes, you can contact me on social at Ski Podcast or by email, theskipodcast@gmail.com. We have had a couple of comments since the last episode. I will just read them. LJ at 99, that's a username on Apple Podcasts. They said, just the best ski and snow sports podcast going. Always listening and learn something new from the interviews, as I'm sure you will have done today, and reports from all over the world. Plus, there's a great back catalogue. And Sarah Lewis on LinkedIn said, lots of interesting and valuable information for listeners. There are now 260 episodes of the Ski Podcast to listen to, and had a look, and a whopping 202 of those to listen to in the last week. So maybe that's you, listener, catching up with our back catalogue. But if it's not, this is a great way to cover that time between seasons, unless you're in Australia or New Zealand, Argentina or Chile, and still keep the vibe going for skiing. Go to theskipodcast.com, have a look around the tags and categories. There are a lot of episodes out there, some brilliant interviews, although I say it myself, so much information out there. Just have a listen to a few of them. And I can tell you that our listeners are all over the world. Around half of them are in the UK in the last week, about a quarter in the States, and everyone else spread as far and wide as, in the last week, Tunisia, China and Mexico. Now, if you like the Ski Podcast, normally I'd ask you to give us a review and things like that. But what I would ask you is that you consider sponsoring my 25 and 25 Snow Camp Challenge. The link is in the show notes. Any amount, no matter how small, will help make a difference. I'm going to be doing that on the 30th of May, and I'll be reporting on it shortly after that. Now, you can follow me at Skipedia and the podcast at Ski Podcast. You can also follow us on WhatsApp, where I release information exclusive and not released on other social media. You can find that link in the show notes. But otherwise, I'd like to thank Al so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
Ian, thank you. That I wasn't sure how that was going to work today, but I think hopefully it's gone okay. Hopefully people have learned little tips and tricks. But
yeah, well, we'll see how it comes out in the edit.
Yeah.
Listen to this as audio on the podcast. You need to go back and watch a video now because some of those things were very visual, but hopefully we've helped. Final listener, thank you for joining us wherever in the world you're listening right now. And until next time, goodbye.